From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the covert relationship between the United States and Israel, a relationship investigated in the new book, Dangerous Liaison. Authors Andrew and Leslie Coburn say an investigation of the October surprise would lead straight to Tel Aviv. Also today, historian Glenda Riley examines the surprisingly long history of divorce in America. And she suggests that divorce is really a part of America's traditional values. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reads a lot of mysteries. She reviews the new movie V.I. Warshawski, based on the work of detective writer Sarah Paretsky. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration has raised the possibility of issuing invitations for a Middle East peace conference and waiting to see who would come. If that strategy is followed, the invitations would be issued by Presidents Bush and Gorbachev in Moscow next week. Barry Schwide has more.
National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft raised the option at a White House briefing on next week's Moscow summit. It could be part of the administration's campaign to get an answer from Israel before the summit. As co-sponsors of the projected peace conference, Presidents Bush and Gorbachev would like to announce in Moscow that Arabs and Israelis are ready to negotiate. Israel is holding back, trying to screen out Palestinians from East Jerusalem. Scowcroft's notion of challenge invitations has a downside, as he quickly acknowledged. Getting a country to negotiate against its will isn't the best psychological setting for successful negotiations. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide in Washington.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev appears to have won preliminary approval for a program of radical reforms to the Communist Party. Delegates to the party's top policymaking body, the Central Committee, passed a resolution today saying that the program was an acceptable basis for further work. Gorbachev's reforms would abandon Marxist-Leninist principles in favor of policies more like those of the Social Democratic parties of Western Europe. Communist conservatives say the reform plan will face real opposition at the next party congress, where the party could split into two groups. Yugoslavia's collective leadership, the federal presidency, has approved a package of measures designed to stop the escalating violence in the breakaway Republic of Croatia. But, as Pierre Vickery reports, the Yugoslav president, Stipe Mesic of Croatia, voted against the package, and the Slovene delegate abstained.
The Yugoslav federal presidency demanded that all warring factions agree to an immediate ceasefire. The Croatian government should withdraw its National Guard units from disputed regions ahead of a demobilization of all Croatian and Serbian paramilitary formations. The Yugoslav army would then return to barracks. The package was immediately rejected by the Yugoslav president, who said the measures would do nothing to stop the mounting death toll in Croatia, where heavy fighting is continuing in several parts of the republic. In Banja, south of the Croatian capital Zagreb, tanks and heavy artillery of the Yugoslav army have again clashed with Croatian National Guard units. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in the Croatian capital, Zagreb.
Stock prices fell slightly today on Wall Street after a session of mixed trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 2,972.5. Declines edged advances in light trading of 127 million shares. This is NPR News. The Israeli government acknowledged today that it has a program to give free land to Jewish settlers in the occupied territories. The United States has opposed Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip as an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. An Israeli government spokesman said the decision to offer free land was made in November of last year by Defense Minister Moshe Arens and Housing Minister Ariel Sharon. An Israeli newspaper charged today that the program was kept secret, but the government spokesman said it was merely unpublished. 10 victims have now been positively identified in the Milwaukee mass murder and dismemberment case. Bruce Winter of member station WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
9 of the 10 victims positively identified are adult males, the other a 14-year-old Laotian teenager. It is the death of the teenager that is prompting criticism of the Milwaukee police force. Police Chief Philip Ariola confirms that the police had contact with the teen as he fled naked and bleeding from his assailant, Jeffrey Dahmer. Dahmer was able to convince police that the matter was a homosexual argument and that the police need not be involved. Police are being criticized for letting Dahmer, who has confessed to the dismemberment slayings, slip through their fingers. An internal police investigation is planned. Authorities now say as many as 17 victims may have been murdered in Dahmer's Milwaukee apartment. For National Public Radio, this is Bruce Winter in Milwaukee.
President Bush has proposed easing the rules that require top officials who leave government service to wait at least a year before they can lobby their former agencies on behalf of private interests. The president's changes would ease the so-called revolving door provisions for people who go from government jobs to political ones. As an example, the changes would allow top government officials to leave their jobs to work in a presidential or congressional election campaign. The proposal would still prohibit such former officials from doing any other kind of lobbying. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For 40 years, American and Israeli intelligence agencies have had a secret relationship. That relationship is investigated in the new book, Dangerous Liaison. The authors are the award-winning journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn. They assert that this covert relationship has played a part in such key events as the Suez Crisis, the Six-Day War of 1967, the Gulf War, and the Iran-Contra scandal. According to the Coburns, the U.S. has used Israel as a surrogate in the Third World to carry out actions the U.S. was prohibited from doing itself. One of the current political hot potatoes for Congress is whether to investigate the October surprise, allegations that Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign made a deal with Iran, promising them arms if they delayed the release of the American hostages until after the election. The Coburns say any investigation of the October surprise will lead straight to Tel Aviv.
Well, what we reveal in the book for the first time is an on-the-record statement by a senior Israeli official, General Avraham Tamir, who told us that from the very beginning of the first Reagan administration, Israel was shipping arms to Iran with full cooperation of the United States, that they got a green light from Al Haig, who was then Secretary of State, to go ahead with shipments. This was at the time very much in Israel's interest because they wanted to fill a gap. They'd sold large quantities of arms to the Shah and wanted to resume those arms sales. And for the United States, it was also important, as General Tamir put it to us, because the United States was very concerned with Soviet influence in the region, particularly at the beginning of the Reagan administration. And it was believed in Washington that if they supported Iran, and likewise they also supported through another proxy, Egypt, Iraq, by supporting both sides, they could keep both countries occupied in what turned out to be a rather bloody war and keep the Soviets out. I think that what's very important in looking at what the senior Israeli told us about these early arms shipments of arms from Israel to Iran with full cooperation from the Reagan administration is that this is a totally different picture than what we got from the Iran-Contra hearings. I mean, as everyone remembers, in the Iran-Contra hearings, weapons, we heard in exhaustive detail about how weapons were transshipped through Israel, weapons were taken from Israeli stocks and given to the Khomeini regime. But this was supposedly only in return for promise of getting out hostages, and it was something that supposedly only happened starting in 1985 and 1986, a very limited operation. What the Israelis tell us is that that is not at all the case, and we now have it on the record from a senior official that indeed these kinds of shipments were going on as early as 1981.
So that if the Congress, they really do start an investigation into the October surprise allegation, which, you know, the allegation is that American diplomats held hostage in Tehran in 1980 were held back at the request of the Reagan campaign in exchange for a promise of future arms deliveries. Those arms deliveries were coming from Israel. So if anyone's going to investigate it, they will willy-nilly come across this arrangement with Israel to sell arms to Iran. And so, given the traditional reluctance on the part of the Congress to sort of look into anything Israel might have been involved in, if the Democrats start digging into this in order to get at the Republican administration, they're going to start uncovering some very embarrassing facts about Israel fairly quickly.
It also means that the whole basis for the hearings in 1987, the big, long hearings that we all listen to every day, that was known as the Iran-Contra business, that the whole basis of that was simply a lie.
What was the lie?
The lie was that what we were looking at here was weapon shipments that began in 1985, arrangements that began previously in the fall of 1984, and that it was a very limited operation of the U.S. and Israel cooperating to arm Iran with the promise of getting back American hostages.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Andrew and Leslie Coburn, two investigative journalists who have co-authored a new book called Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the Israel-U.S. covert relationship. Now, you date this U.S.-Israeli covert relationship to 1951, when the CIA agreed to accept an offer from Israeli Prime Minister Ben-Gurion to give the CIA access to Israel's connections in the East Bloc and the Soviet Union. What was the nature of this arrangement the way you've researched it?
Well, that's right. The Israelis, the government of Israel at that time, was nervous about what it saw as a lack of support at the highest levels in Washington, particularly from the State Department and the Pentagon. And they wanted to be able to offer something to the Americans, that to make themselves indispensable in some way. The CIA at that time, the Cold War was, you know, at its coldest, was desperate for intelligence about what was going on behind the Iron Curtain in the Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. The Israelis had these networks, you know, because of the very large Jewish population in those regions, had access to a great amount of intelligence information, which was of great interest to the CIA. Also, there were people emigrating from the communist countries to Israel, and they could be debriefed when they arrived in Israel. This was what the Israelis offered the CIA, and which the CIA was very happy to accept. And that was it was from this agreement in May 1951 that we date what we call the covert relationship between the U.S. and Israel.
So what did Israel want out of that relationship?
Well, Israel really wanted an ally, particularly in Washington, an institutional ally. I mean, their view was that, you know, administrations change, policies change, the State Department policy could change, but if you had an enduring link with an intelligence agency, something that would keep going irrespective of what, you know, the State Department policy might be that particular day, or, you know, what the policy at the top of the Pentagon might be, something that was secret, that was in the background, that went on, something that the Americans wanted, the CIA wanted, then they would have and would keep a powerful ally in Washington. And that is indeed what happened.
Did any money change hands in this relationship?
Later on, it began to. It's certainly a lot of money. In the later 50s, the CIA instituted an operation or program called KK Mountain, which was involved payments of up to $20 million a year sometimes out of a special, very sort of secret compartment within the CIA funding process, which went to Mossad. And that was to finance or payment to Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, to run operations on behalf of the CIA throughout the Third World and particularly in Africa.
So you're suggesting that Israeli intelligence in some instances became the proxy for the United States and did things that United States would have been prohibited from doing, so it had Israel do it for it? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. The proxy is a good word. In fact, Israelis have used it themselves. It's not necessarily, sometimes it's when the U.S. or the CIA was prohibited from doing things, such as, for example, after the Marxist government took power in Angola in 1975, the CIA moved quickly and started an operation to destabilize the new government and to back a rival faction. The Congress found out about this and forbade the CIA to do it. At that point, the Israelis stepped in, were asked to step in, and the Israelis started training the rebels, and the Israelis started giving arms instruction and playing a very, important role in the whole operation. Sometimes it's when, you know, something's just too difficult or embarrassing. For instance, else earlier on in Africa, the CIA, although it did work there, had some problems because the Americans were regarded by the newly independent regimes that appeared in the 1960s as sort of neo-colonialists, you know, linked with the old imperial powers of France and Britain. So it was harder for them to penetrate these new states. The Israelis didn't have that problem. They were regarded by the new governments, black African governments in the 1960s, as, you know, former colonials like themselves, and they were, you know, they were welcomed. So the Israelis were better able to penetrate these new countries on behalf of the CIA. So it was a very good example of the kind of ways that Israel's been able to make itself useful to the CIA and over the years.
Did any of your sources tell you things that happened behind the scenes, you know, in secret between the United States and Israel during the Gulf War?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is that there were two occasions when Israel wanted to send a force of highly trained commandos to go into western Iraq. The first was before the war. It was in June of 1990. Israel wanted to send the forces in to knock out Saddam's chemical installations. The U.S. put its foot down at the time and said no. There was another very tense moment during the ground war when Israel asked permission to again send commandos into western Iraq, airborne commandos, to knock out the mobile Scud launchers, as one former chief of Israeli military intelligence put it to us during the war in Tel Aviv. We wanted to touch them with our hands. I think that when the White House put its foot down and said, no, you can't do it, we do not want you sending in commandos, they said it very forcefully, and it was a much more tense situation than we've been led to believe.
The example that you're giving where Israel asked the United States for permission to send in troops, in your book you suggest that that Israel has been asking the United States for permission for a lot of things long before the Gulf War.
Absolutely right. We've come to the conclusions in looking at these different operations that generally that is the case, that Israel doesn't act unless it gets some kind of green light from Washington. Certainly any operation in what they regard as the United States' backyard in Latin America, they would never do anything there without checking it out with Washington. Also, you have cases in Israel's wars where, in 1967, for example, the chief of Mossad had to come to Washington to ask for the green light and come back to Tel Aviv. There was a very important late-night, midnight meeting where he announced that Washington said it would be very happy if they could crush Nasser. And that was terribly important in their decision to act.
Well, to start the Six-Day War, which, you know, changed the face, gave us the Middle East we live with today.
If you're just joining us, my guests are journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn. They've co-authored a new book called Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship. What do you think the state of the relationship now is between the United States and Israel in the light of the peace talks that James Baker has been trying to organize since the end of the war? Shamir has been very reluctant to participate. The negotiations about this are still going on. You're talking about this really tight relationship between the United States and Israel, but that's not what we're seeing in the issue of peace talks.
We're talking about a secret relationship that's to do with intelligence matters and defense matters, a sort of, you know, a behind-the-scenes relationship. It's certainly true that, you know, relations between this administration and Israel have appeared to be, you know, cooler than they've been in the past. Nonetheless, I mean, this, you know, the covert relationship continues. That's still there in the background. U.S. aid still flows in, you know, enormous billions of dollars flow as a matter of routine to Israel, despite what, you know, what rude things politicians might say to each other. And, in fact, the U.S., you know, the negotiations that are being set up, you know, the procedure incorporates a number of many concessions to Israel on this. So I would say that relationship, you know, although it might seem a little colder than it's been in the past, is hardly over.
But, you know, following through on this theory of the covert relationship, if it was a stronger relationship, as you're painting it, you think that the United States would be able to pull some secret strings behind the scenes and Israel would just sign up for these peace talks?
Well, Israel has signed up for these peace talks, so, you know, the United States has pulled the string. I think, the string was the money that Israel wants. So I would say that, you know, everything we see happening indicates that, you know, when the United States pulls the string and really means it, when the United States is really interested in achieving something, as they seem to be at the moment, then they get what they want. And the Israelis may huff and puff and create a big, you know, fuss about it and, you know, exercise delaying tactics. But, you know, as it seems now, they're falling into line with what the Americans want.
Andrew and Leslie Coburn co-authored the new book, Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship. Coming up, we get a different perspective on that relationship from Benny Morris, an Israeli historian who's just completed a study of his country's intelligence services. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. After I spoke with Andrew and Leslie Coburn about their analysis of the covert relationship between Israel and the United States, we called Israel to speak with historian Benny Morris. He has also researched Israel's intelligence services. He co-authored the new book, Israel's Secret Wars. Like the Coburns, he dates the Israeli-American covert relationship back to 1951. But unlike the Coburns, he doesn't see the relationship as dangerous.
The intelligence services of Western countries, many of them have relationships with the other intelligence services of the democratic and non-democratic countries. The Israeli relationship is as legitimate or illegitimate as any other relationship. Obviously, it's secret because that's how intelligence services operate. I don't think it's dangerous. I think that the relationships between the intelligence services of democratic countries usually serve the interests of the democratic countries. And often have enemies who are anti-democratic, and therefore it's good that they share information and other things.
The charges that the Coburns make is that in this particular secret relationship between the United States and Israel, the United States sometimes used Israel as a proxy to do things that the United States wasn't legally allowed to do or practically just couldn't do. Do you have any evidence of that?
Firstly, I haven't read Mr. Coburn's book, so I can't really comment on what it contains. I'm sure that there are covert things which were done jointly. There are probably also covert things done separately, both by the CIA and the Mossad, on the basis of information which the other agency gave it. I'm also sure that favors were done by each side for the other side. I don't know if any of this or all of this was illegal in any way or dangerous to anyone whom it shouldn't be dangerous to.
I'd like to ask you about Israel's arms shipments to Iran. The Coburns say that any congressional investigation of the October surprise will lead straight to Israel and the covert partnership that has existed between Israel and the United States. What do you think?
I don't think anything on the subject because I don't know anything. The only thing I can say is that it doesn't have anything, as far as I know, to do with arms from Israel to Iran. Perhaps the Coburns know something about various Israeli personalities who may have helped various Republicans make connections in Iran. I don't know. But I don't think it has any quid pro quo connection with Israeli arms shipments to Iran, because the timing, as far as I know, is wrong.
initial Israeli shipments, as far as I know, to Iran of spare parts and munitions, which were small scale in any case, as far as I know, began late 81 and 82, and you're talking in terms of the, what you call the October surprise, you're talking in terms of 1980.
The Israeli arms shipments in question in the Iran-Contra story are arms shipments from the mid-80s, but...
So there's two sets. Iran-Contra's from 84-85, that's the second set. The first set is earlier, precedes Iran-Contra, and that, I believe, is 82 we're talking about.
What's the difference in those two series of arms shipments?
Well, one is connected to the American desire to build bridges to the so-called moderates in Iran, and Israeli desires to build bridges to the moderates in Iran, and may have been American-initiated, or at least in a larger sense it was American-initiated, even if there were Israeli triggers to it. The first shipments were Israeli-inspired and were basically to send spare parts to Iran to make money and, I think, in part to salvage the Israeli-Iranian relationship and to help Iranian Jews. But they're two distinct... and they were stopped. That is, the shipments of 82 at some point, as far as I remember, under American pressure, were stopped. America desisted from giving its backing to the shipments, as far as I remember. Whereas the second set were initiated by America and were stopped for other reasons, not American pressure.
Now, what about the Iran-Contra scandal? Do you think that there's an Israeli connection there?
There was certainly an Israeli connection. Israel was the conduit through which arms were transferred to Iran. The money which was obtained was then in part used to finance the arming of Contras in Nicaragua. I'm not sure how aware Israel was of the use of these funds after they were received from Tehran, but that wasn't the Israeli interest. The Israeli interest wasn't the Contras, even if they knew about it. The Israeli interest was probably largely to help out the American big brother, and secondly, to make money, and thirdly, to maintain its geopolitical connection with, as I explained before, with the peripheral great power, non-Arab great power in the area, which is Iran. And to help it, if you like, fight Iraq, which was a persistent Israeli enemy since 1948.
How is it legal for Israel to be the surrogate of the United States in sending arms to Iran?
Well, it's not, as I tried to explain, it's not a surrogate. It's a country conducting its foreign policy with its own interests at heart. If those interests also coincide with those of Washington, then that's all to the good, because Washington is an Israeli ally and Israel wants to help it. But Israeli foreign policy required a strong link as possible with Iran, and included sales of arms to Iran. And if money could be made out of it, so much the better. And if Iranian Jews could be protected by it, so much the better. There's nothing illegal about Israel selling arms. Perhaps one day, when Israel is in a safer position in the world and can start and richer and can start selecting who to sell arms to and who not to, and sets up laws about who this should, you know, regulating this sort of these arms sales, its own arms sales, then perhaps there'll be room for investigation if something happens which is contrary to law. But at the moment, Israeli arms sales, which are incidentally extremely secret, the whole business is very secret, not like in America, is in the hands of the government, and then it conducts policy as it sees fit.
Benny Morris co-authored the new book, Israel's Secret Wars, A History of Israel's Intelligence Services. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. sure the divorce rate has climbed in the past few decades, but there was more divorce in early American history than you'd think. Coming up, historian Glenda Riley examines how legal and moral values about divorce have changed in America through the centuries. Mystery fans have long been familiar with Sarah Paretsky's novels, featuring her tough-talking, good-looking woman private eye, V.I. Warshawski. Now Paretsky's creation is coming to a theater near you. Critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new movie, V.I. Warshawski. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party has voted to accept President Gorbachev's latest reform plan, which calls for the party to move away from long-held positions. However, hardliners are expected to fight for concessions before approving the final version. Bridget Kendall of the BBC reports.
There's little doubt that this week's Central Committee plenum has ended in a tactical victory for Mikhail Gorbachev, but it's a triumph that could well be short-lived. An overwhelming majority of Central Committee members did vote to endorse President Gorbachev's draft program, which in effect abandons 70 years of Marxist-Leninist dogma in favor of a Western-style socialist party. But that doesn't mean the largely conservative body of top party officials has accepted the change outright. Grumblings from hardliners that the new program wasn't socialist enough and that it abandoned the workers made that clear. And at a news conference afterwards, senior officials insisted that the Central Committee had approved the draft only on condition that their reservations were taken into account. In effect, that the draft would be substantially watered down.
Bridget Kendall of the BBC reporting from Moscow. President Bush has lifted a freeze on Kuwaiti assets, but in a separate order, kept a freeze on Iraqi assets in this country. In issuing the Iraqi order, Mr. Bush said that it was due in part to hostile activities against U.S. interest in the Persian Gulf area. After the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait last August, the president banned business dealings with both countries. Egyptian President Mubarak says that the makeup of a Palestinian delegation to any future peace conference in the Middle East should not be used as a pretext to block the peace process. The Egyptian leader was in Paris today for a meeting with the president of France. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Hosni Mubarak said the problem of who's represented in a Palestinian delegation is complicating the peace process. He said, let us put all of the cards on the table when the conference convenes, but not create problems now for those who are working for peace. The issue of the makeup of a Palestinian delegation appears to be one of the main obstacles to holding a conference. Palestinians insist their compatriots from Arab East Jerusalem should be included in a Palestinian delegation. But Israel has ruled that out for fear it would call into question its claim over the whole city. Israel's prime minister said he is not willing to trade land for peace, but Mubarak said that once the conference opens, the status of East Jerusalem should be discussed. He said it's part of the occupied territories, whether we like it or not. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 7 points to close at 2,972.50 on volume of 127 million shares. This is NPR News. In Washington, according to U.S. Defense Department estimates, the U.S. spent over $61 billion in the Persian Gulf War. This includes over $43 billion from allied nations. However, the Pentagon says this figure can go up because of continuing deployment, including U.S. forces still in the Persian Gulf area. As of June, allied governments had given over $43 billion out of over $54.5 billion promised. Saudi Arabia pledged close to $17 billion and has paid less than $12 billion, and Kuwait still owes almost $5 billion. In London, a British newspaper report about the activities of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International says the bank was involved in efforts by three countries to acquire nuclear arms. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
The report in this morning's Guardian newspaper alleges the bank aided a joint effort by Argentina, Libya, and Pakistan to obtain nuclear weapons. Citing unidentified sources inside and outside the bank, The paper says that BCCI's global reach made it easy for the joint operation to transfer large sums of money wherever needed to obtain nuclear weapons technology. The bank is also said to have arranged for shipping and handling of the nuclear components that were acquired, and for the legal fees of agents caught trying to illegally obtain more. Today's report comes after allegations yesterday linking BCCI to terrorist groups, the CIA, and Pakistan's heroin trade. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
In this country, the city of Detroit is suing the federal government concerning the 1990 census. City officials in Detroit say almost 100,000 people were left out under the latest government tabulation. Under the lawsuit filed in federal court in Detroit, officials call for a new count, including people living in homeless shelters and public housing. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Divorce may strike some as antithetical to traditional American values, but historian Glenda Riley has found there's a long tradition of divorce in America. Riley teaches American history at Ball State University. Her new book is called Divorce, an American Tradition. One of her previous books is about women on the American frontier. I asked Riley if there were common beliefs about divorce that she hopes her new book will dispel.
Well, I think one of the most important ones is that most contemporary Americans think that the high divorce rate is a 20th century phenomenon, mostly a phenomenon of the 1980s and 1990s. And they fail to realize that divorce has a very long history in this country, in fact, dating back to the Puritans.
What about the rate of divorce today? It's still higher than it's ever been, isn't it?
Well, the rate of divorce is extremely high. It's the highest in the world, and of course it's the highest in our history. But that's a little more complex topic than it first looks like on the surface. For one thing, people live longer these days, and so marriages that would have ended with the death of one spouse or the other now often end in divorce. Also, people divorce in multiple numbers these days, so that one person might contribute four or five divorces to the divorce rate. And also, I've speculated that it's not quite as easy to desert as it used to be because of Social Security numbers and insurance and property and computers, so that there are some reasons for that very high divorce rate besides the divorces themselves.
Now, your book says that the first divorce in the United States dates back to colonial days, to the Puritans. And you say that for them, divorce was a matter of civil law, not religion.
Right. When the Puritans first came to this country in 1620, they immediately instituted a reform that marriage should be a civil procedure rather than ecclesiastical. And that was part of their break from the Anglican Church. It was also part of the ideas they'd picked up during their time in Holland. And that opened the way for divorce eventually, because if marriage is a civil contract, then it follows logically that that contract can be dissolved. So it was 1639 when the first woman got a divorce. And it's interesting that it was a woman. You might think that men would be the first to go to the divorce court since they had more legal savvy and more money and more mobility. But she pled that her husband already had a wife. And the court immediately granted her a divorce and was quite hard on him in terms of what he had to pay. And then they even deported him, punished him, and then deported him.
When America got its independence from England and states started creating their own divorce laws, what were some of the regional differences you could see early on in the history of America?
Between the various regions and the various states?
Yeah.
Well, New York was extremely conservative. Alexander Hamilton first proposed that divorces should just be given for the biblical reason of adultery, and New York stuck to that until very, very recently. Massachusetts, as you might expect, was rather liberal and had a large number of grounds for divorce. And I'm saying, as you might expect, because of the Puritan background of already granting divorces for many years. The South slowly caught up. Virginia began to grant divorces in the early 1800s, and then the legislature got very disgusted with the drain on their time. So they shifted it to the courts, and as they shifted it, they gave the judges a great deal of discretion, which actually liberalized divorce in the state of Virginia. Now, one of the reasons that we have so many state laws, differing state laws on divorce, is, again, the precedents that were set in the colonial times. Every colonial government wanted to govern their own citizens' marital status, and so it established a precedent of states' rights in that area. And later, a reform movement came along that said, well, no, let's have a national law and all do it the same way so that you won't have people escaping New York to Nevada, for example. And most of the states resisted that and did not want to give up that state's rights. So that's why we have such a complicated situation today with divorce law.
How did some places in the West, like Reno, Nevada, become divorce mills?
Well, there's a very clear answer to that. In the Western areas, as they were settled, haste was very important. If you wanted to settle up and you wanted to attract people to your region, then you needed to give them the right to vote, the right to practice their profession, the right to hold office as quickly as you could. And usually it was a matter of 10 days, 30 days residence, and you could become a citizen of that area. Well, then it follows that to take other illegal actions, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, seems very long by comparison. So Western areas often said 60 days residence for a divorce. And that attracted people from other regions who then came and took advantage of that. And there is no law in this country that says you have to be an American citizen. So people even came from other countries to take advantage of that. And it was not just Reno, but before Reno, long before Reno, places like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Fargo, North Dakota were known as divorce mills. They were actually forerunners to Reno. But as soon as there was a conservative backlash and criticism, then they began to tighten up their laws. I think in the case of Nevada, they saw that it brought in the tourist dollar. It brought in gamblers. It really became very crucial in a roundabout way, not divorce itself, but the people it brought into the state to establish that residency. It became crucial to their economy.
Did you travel to Reno for background for your book?
I did.
What's it like now in terms of divorce, since divorce has become easier to get in other states?
Well, the statistics show that since no-fault divorce, migratory divorce in Reno has dropped off. But another interesting thing has developed in that now people aren't shopping so much for the lowest residency in divorce, but they're shopping for where they can get the best settlement. So people are still getting migratory divorces, and they still do go to places like Reno because they get better property settlements. But that in itself has then created a terrible ball of legal wax because they go back to their own state and the other partner refuses to agree with that property settlement or child care settlement, and then it often ends up in another suit in their home state in an attempt to decide which judgment will prevail.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Glenda Riley. She's a historian and the author of the new book, Divorce, An American Tradition. We'll talk more about divorce after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Historian Glenda Riley is my guest, and we're talking about divorce. Let's look at divorce today with no-fault divorce in many states. What do you think of the no-fault divorce laws and how well they're working?
Well, they're not working well at all from the viewpoint of many women and children. And I remember no-fault, and I remember how we felt about no-fault. People generally, especially feminists, thought it was going to be wonderful, that it was going to be a step toward equalizing relationships between men and women, that it was going to bring women up to an economic and a psychological par with men. And what happened in reality was that women did not move into the job market as fast as we expected. They did not receive equal pay as fast as we expected. They did not get educational opportunities as fast as we expected. So the reality is that in no-fault divorce, women come away with less than equal by far. For example, if they've stayed home and they don't have the job experience that the man in the marriage does, yes, they get half the property, but they walk out without the same earning ability. And so after a divorce, typically a man's income goes up and a woman's drops. Typically also she gets the children, so here she's trying to either go back to school or get a job, upper job experience, and raise children at the same time and pay their expenses. And of course many men default, our default rate is very high in child support, so that leaves her without that income.
Do you see any movements afoot that would like to tighten up the divorce laws and make divorce more difficult to get?
Yes, there are regular outcries in that area, and certainly from churches, moral majority, and I think that their stand is quite understandable. My own position is that divorce is not the problem, that it's marriage, and that we need to look at the other end. We need to start educating people better for marriage, making them think more about why they choose a mate, helping them choose a mate, and instead of worrying about divorce ruining the marriage, worrying about the choices in courtship and what the people do during the course of the course of marriage. For example, one of the things I argue in the book is that we need to give more support in this society to existing marriages. People are two-earner families now. We need to give child care, take that stress off the marriage. And it seems to me that's a way of avoiding divorce, by providing those services to existing marriages.
From your historical research, do you think stricter divorce laws would ever succeed in keeping relationships together?
No, and that's one of the things I argued throughout the book very strongly, is that historical evidence shows that if you have a strict divorce law, as in New York, many people left New York and went to Nevada and got migratory divorces. There was a very high annulment rate, a very high legal separation rate in New York, both of which fell dramatically after New York liberalized their divorce laws. There were also firms in New York that gave you a package deal. Now remember, the only ground is adultery, so you hired the firm who set you up with a hotel, a partner, a photographer, witnesses, shammed an adultery case, and then took all this into court and got your divorce. So it seems to me from that and other instances that people will find a way around their marriage. They'll take other partners, they'll drum up a separation, they'll think of a reason to get an annulment, they'll live separately. So to have a strict divorce law is not going to keep people together.
I guess the rate of lying would go up, because if you lie creatively, you can make your relationship conform to the stricter divorce law.
Well, that's another interesting thing in dealing with divorce documents. Several scholars and historians lately have started pulling out divorce petitions and saying, well, now this tells us a lot about marriage. And I agree, it tells something about a marriage. But I think also you have to be very careful in using divorce petitions as sources, because people who went in for divorces had to meet the legal requirements of that state. So they had to plea cruelty or desertion or whatever the state accepted as a grounds. And they also tended to worst case their plea because they wanted a good settlement. So I think you have to be very careful with the divorce petitions themselves. One other thing that I argue in the book is that if we look at divorce historically, it takes off some of the pressure of urbanization and industrialization and technology. We tend to say that divorce has been created by those factors. But if you go back and you see that we have had a high divorce rate already during the Victorian period, 1 out of 14, and that we've had a very high divorce rate in the Western states, which only recently have become urbanized and industrialized, then it makes you wonder how many divorces really were caused by industrialization and urbanization. And what I started to argue was that perhaps we need to look at the underlying philosophy Americans have of how they deal with problems. And we do tend to split when we're confronted by a problem. We left Europe, we left the British Empire, and I liken the Declaration of Independence to a great divorce petition. We went west. And even today, you don't like it, well, you go seek freedom, liberty, pursuit of happiness, whatever all that means. So I think that divorcing is a very logical way for Americans to deal with a personal problem, just as they have dealt with larger problems.
Have you found that the language of divorce has really changed? For instance, I don't think you hear that many people now talking about how their marriage failed.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one thing I did with this section on the self-help literature. The early manuals told people that they were a failure if their marriages ended. Those manuals told women, even in the 1940s, that they could expect stigma, they could expect to be cut off from their friends. By the 1950s, they were saying, well, you can live a life, you can get a job, and you can get satisfactions from your job that you might have gotten from a marriage. By the 1960s, they were starting to reject the concept of divorce as a failure and saying, well, sometimes this is necessary, it's a necessary amputation. By the 1970s, with the influence of the women's movement, they were urging women to think about ending marriages. And by the 1980s, divorce had become a self-fulfilling experience, a growth experience in the self-help literature. A radical change in thinking and language over those decades.
Glenda Riley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
Glenda Riley is the author of Divorce, an American Tradition. It's published by Oxford University Press. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. There is one report today of a ceasefire that's been ordered in Yugoslavia by the federal presidency there in the fighting between Croatia and Serbia. Thousands of Croatians who live in this country and Canada have come to Washington, D.C., some by bus overnight, to demonstrate. They want the Bush administration to recognize Croatia's declaration of independence, and I'll talk with a few of them. Also, Margot Adler reports on what New Yorkers really think of their city and the people who live there. And we'll update the Milwaukee mass murder story, where parts of 11 bodies have been found in an apartment building.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. According to the cover story of this week's New York Magazine, this is the summer of killer women in the movies. Thelma and Louise, Terminator 2, and La Femme Nikita all feature tough women characters who go ballistic when they're provoked. The new movie V.I. Warshawski promised to continue the trend. It stars Kathleen Turner as a Chicago private eye, and it's based on a character of the same name created by mystery writer Sarah Paretsky. Critic Maureen Corrigan says the cinematic V.I. Warshawski is less a female Sam Spade and more like that 60s cream puff Honey West.
When the first V.I. Warshawski novel appeared in 1982, it ended the male monopoly on hard-boiled detective fiction. Sure, there had been female sleuths before, but V.I. carries a gun instead of Miss Marple's knitting needles. And unlike Emma Peel, V.I. always walks down the mean streets of the city alone. V.I. is also a product of the feminist movement. She uses her initials instead of her first two names, Victoria Iphigenia, to prevent men from calling her Vicky. She's a law school graduate and a karate black belt, and she became a private eye so she could keep her autonomy. I was rightfully skeptical when I heard that Kathleen Turner had been cast as V.I. In the books, V.I. is attractive, but she's no bombshell. Turner boosts V.I.'s body heat and does nothing to convey her other, brainier qualities. The only concession Turner makes to playing a gritty gumshoe is her voice. Sometimes, when she's acting real mean, she turns nasal and sounds like Ethel Merman. Otherwise, Turner is all golden curls and sultry gazes. More than Turner, the scriptwriters are to blame for this makeover of V.I. into Modesty Blaze. They've let V.I. keep her feminism only so she can use it to tease men. Early in the movie, V.I. is in a bar when she notices a cute hockey player named Boom Boom. She maneuvers a meeting by assertively tripping him with one of her work shoes, red sequined stiletto heels.
Could I have it back, please?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Now look at that, it fits.
A real Cinderella story. Would you like to sit down?
Yeah, thank you. So, Cinderella, what's your name?
V.I. Warshawski.
V.I.? What does V stand for?
Virtuous. In a manner of speaking.
You're a funny lady.
Try beautiful. It works much better, believe me.
In the novels, V.I. would never waggle her tail and beg for male approval like this. Fortunately, Boom Boom is bumped off shortly after this meeting, and V.I. is hired by his 13-year-old daughter to find the murderers. In turn, the daughter helps V.I. unearth her suppressed maternal instincts. At one point, V.I. is drugged, and as she's drifting into unconsciousness, she murmurs, "I'd make a good mother, wouldn't I?" What a relief. Down deep, this gun-toting single woman with the androgynous name really wants to be somebody's mother. In the novels, V.I. cares more about the Chicago Cubs than she does about having little cubs of her own. But that didn't stop the scriptwriters. The power of V.I.'s innate maternal instincts is confirmed when Boom Boom's ex-wife appears and tries to kill her daughter for her inheritance. The good surrogate mother, V.I., then has to fight this monster mother. Sound familiar? It's the plot of Aliens. Sigourney Weaver's Ripley was also too fierce for mass consumption, so Hollywood feminized her aggression by giving her a child to protect. V.I. Warshawski is a lousy detective movie, but it does pose one intriguing mystery. How did Thelma and Louise get away with it? How did they smash through the roadblocks Hollywood places in the path of tough women characters without a reassuring child strapped in the back seat of their convertible?
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgin directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester, and it's performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. All made up and soon you'll be appearing. Every bit of nervousness is gone, and the sound that's music to your hearing, to hear them cheering when you come on. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. How I wish the folks at home could only see what's come to any, how proud they'd be. Getting paid for doing what comes naturally. Let's go on with the show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, ballerina Suzanne Farrell talks with us about her long relationship on and off stage with the late choreographer George Balanchine. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.